Dr. Dennis McKenna, that's got to bring back some memories for you, I suppose, huh?
Absolutely.
You were there, and just about at that time. You know, socially, do you think, Doctor, that it was the right direction at the wrong time?
How do you mean?
Well, I mean the whole 60s thing, the whole San Francisco scene, the whole national scene, frankly. It was moving toward a gentler, more aware social time for the young people, but then sort of the war got in the way, and then we started the war on drugs and war and war and war. But
right.
For a while there, we were headed in a bit of a different direction, weren't we?
Well, we were headed in a bit of a different direction, and yes, I think that the war in Vietnam had a lot to do with derailing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that also just sort of the disillusion that happened in the American dream that probably started with the assassination of Kennedy, if not before. I mean, I think that really impacted a lot of people in my generation. You know, I can remember when that happened, and both Terrence and myself, we were just in a state of shock for days after that happened. There was little you could do except just stare at television. You know, a lot of people of our generation thought that Kennedy was, you know, was the sign of some needed change. And when he was struck down, I think it was kind of a message that no, nothing is really going to change. I mean, you know, however flawed he may have been as a man, I think he symbolized a change for a lot of people. And I think when that went away, you know, I think it began the process of deepening cynicism that has continued. And then
we sort of moved toward, as the decades went by, it seems like we moved from where we were in the 60s and where we were headed to a more materialistic society.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of replaced what went on with the 60s with materialism. Anyway, listen, I want to ask you a question that's a sensitive question and about Terrence, and it was actually a question that I asked Terrence, and I guess I would like to ask you. Many, many people said brain tumor.
Right.
Why should we not believe that it's possible that some of the substances and chemicals and things that Terrence did contributed to that, may have been a main contributor to that brain tumor?
Right.
I'm sure you've thought about it.
Well, I have thought about it, and the answer is that there's simply no evidence for it. If psychedelics or cannabis caused brain tumors, there would be a lot more
brain tumors,
that kind of thing, than there are. Brain tumors, that particularly the kind that he had, is actually an extremely rare form of cancer. Only 20,000 cases a year supposedly are reported in this country, although I personally think it must be more than that. But as cancers go, this one is rare. And, you know, there's simply no evidence. There's no correlation between your intake of marijuana, say, and brain tumors. In fact, there is research that has been done that shows that cannabis, you know, tetrahydrocannabinol may inhibit brain tumors.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, for my brother, this didn't work, but, you know, I mean, you can say that, but it's not really a fair criticism. You know, I mean, another person who maybe never touches any of these things may get a brain tumor, and you may say, well, you know, it's because they led a bad life or something.
Sure.
I mean, I just don't, it just doesn't hold up.
All right. Before going to the phone lines here, Scott in Sonora, California asks a question that may not even be relevant, or you may know what he's talking about, but he says, please ask Dr. McKenna if he remembers what he was experiencing when he said that, quote, he didn't want to be a giant insect, end quote, at the experiment at La Carrera.
Is La Chirera.
La Chirera, okay.
Right.
So it rings a bell, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you didn't want to be a giant insect. What was that all about?
Well, it's hard to explain that without sort of going into the whole narrative of what got us to go to La Truera at the first place, which we started talking about at the top of the program, but then we sort of got derailed into other subjects. But I guess to put it in a nutshell, a lot of the ideas and concerns that we were sort of processing at La Truera in these hyper-psychedelic states had to do with the notion of insect metamorphosis, and you know, insects undergo several stages of metamorphosis, like a butterfly, a caterpillar turning into a butterfly is the classic example. Mm-hmm. And we had some notions, whether correct or not, at least we thought at the time they seemed correct, that the tryptamines and the beta-carbolines in this plant environment had to do with a kind of an actual metamorphosis in humans.
I see.
And that, you know, and that was what the basis of that was about. I wasn't so sure I wanted to undergo this metamorphosis.
I see.
And I was convinced that I was about to.
I bet you saw the fly, didn't you?
Actually, I've never seen it.
Oh, you haven't seen the fly?
I haven't seen it.
It's just as well,
I should put it on my list.
Uh-huh. Obviously, you're not exactly an anti-drug poster child, and nor was your brother. Your brother was a brilliant, brilliant man. You're a brilliant, brilliant man. And a lot of people who are fighting this drug war, I don't think, like hearing you speak, because you're obviously brilliant, and somehow the brain cells have stayed in place throughout whatever it is you have done, as was the case with Terrence.
So far.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Dennis McKenna. Hi.
Hi, Art. I'm Laura, and I'm a PhD candidate in a Washington, D.C. area university, and I'm doing the first ethnographic life history narrative-based research study with near-death experiencers.
Oh?
So I'm getting some very interesting findings, which I'd like to talk to you about more at some other time. Now, you guys kept talking while I was after I made the notes I wanted to make, because I had a chance to spend some time with Terrence and Palenque, and I had a couple comments that I wanted from Dennis. But a question you just raised about the brain tumor and the drug use.
Yes.
Raised the issue for me of, remember the Miami guy who had the strange heart attack and the bizarre little sort of twist in his vein or artery?
Oh, yes.
And the Native Americans who pointed out that, you know, from where their point of view, that's called an energy attack. I'm not sound too paranoid. I just wanted to throw that in as another question that might be asked. I have a wonderful quote from Terrence about an experience of Dennis's that your insect thing made me want to read, but let me hold off because maybe we don't have time. But I'm loving hearing from Dennis, and I love spending time with Terrence. Read all their work. I think the research that they have done and the personal accounts that they have shared are not simply valuable, but extremely brave to stand out on the edge they're standing out on. And there's tremendous resistance. As Terrence said, culture is not your friend in certain contexts.
I would agree with that.
And I wanted to raise this. The reason I was there is I got a scholarship that year. That fellow from Texas gave some scholarships. And I got to go to Palenque and spend this 10 days having this wonderful ethnobotanical field seminar with an incredible group of people, including the Shulgins and Terrence, and because I realized that there were analogs between near-death experience narratives, and I'm a near-death experiencer, as was my mother, which, you know, fueled my interest.
Well, you obviously heard the comments earlier with respect to DMT.
Well, no.
Oh, you
did? Both the light-related experiences related to ayahuasca. With now, a lot is in the research, near-death studies research about ketamine, which I know the least about. But I went there because that woman who was involved in Iboga research, Ibogaine.
Deborah Nash. Dr. Deborah Nash.
Dr. Deborah Nash was going to be there. And there is this analog between NDEs and that experience in the Life Review that's very, very obvious. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to say you hadn't mentioned Scott Pastora, nor, I think, ketamine, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about them. The other thing I found that was bizarre, that didn't come up in clinical NDE model-shaped research, this is work I'm continuing now that I did 2 years' work of field research on for my MA. Now it's continuing as my just-approved dissertation work, is that there was this major, inexplicably high incidence of narratives where it was clear there was sort of overlap between that you could take a batch of these, change a few characteristics, hand them to alien encounter researchers like John Mack,
mm-hmm.
or near-death experience researchers, and each of those groups would go near-death experience or alien encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And because so many of my informants, it came up with so many of my informants, and the only other research that's come up in that high incidence is PMH Atwater, who, like me, her methodology involves more person-centered, informant-generated narrative. So you get data you wouldn't get. I would never have thought to mention a strange experience that I had, one connected maybe with the one that Dennis and Terrence had in True Hallucinations, which I'd love to hear him talk about.
All right. Listen, we're way short on time.
Yeah, so I'd like to know what does he make of this overlap and the fact that we're trying to model experiences we may not know as much about as we think
we know. Okay.
A lot of things have been touched on. I think that this notion, this business of the aliens and encounters with the aliens in abduction experiences, the near-death experiences, and also in psychedelics. What do I make of it? I'm not sure what to make of it. On one hand, the rational reductionist part of me says, it's got to be part of the self. Certainly with psychedelics, you would think, no matter how other it seems to be, ultimately these things are coming from some part of the self. It may not be a part that you know very much. That's the reductionist model. The other, it's possible to look at it another way. Maybe there are other dimensions. And what we mean by other dimensions, I'm not sure. Maybe some other level of etheric vibration.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? More familiar, more, other people on your program know more about this than I do. I just feel like all bets are off, in a sense, that particularly when we're trying to understand the mind and what the capabilities of the mind are and how it interfaces with reality, we can't really make any assumptions.
Well, our nation's best physicists are talking about multiple dimensions.
Well, exactly.
And who is to say that
parallel worlds?
That there is not a path and a door opened. Comment briefly, if you would, on ketamine. Ketamine is being called the NDE drug.
My own experience with ketamine is extremely limited. I've only taken it one time in my life. And I didn't find it, that it wasn't pleasant for me. It was interesting. It was sort of, it was sort of like an anti-psychedelic to me, in the sense that it seemed to be a state of sensory deprivation and complete isolation from the body.
Wow.
And sort of like, how in states of sensory deprivation you start to confabulate, you start to fill that empty space.
Yes.
With thoughts.
Yes, of course.
And ketamine was like that for me. Beyond that, I don't know. It may be the NDE drug. I'm not sure. My own candidate for that would be something like 5-methoxy-DMT. Which is actually an order of magnitude more potent than DMT in terms of what the dose is, but its effects are somewhat similar, although it doesn't have a marked visual effect. You don't see, colored hallucinations as so much on 5-methoxy-DMT, but yet it's just as profound, and it seems to be, at least, again, my experience is somewhat limited with this, but the few times I have encountered it, you do seem to go to a place which seems close to what they describe as this near-death experience.
That's amazing. All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Dennis McKenna. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning. God, I'm having a flashback.
yeah, I bet.
I was a runaway flower child in 1964, became an electric acid test flower child, Ken Kesey style. Wound up in 1967 living on a hippie houseboat in the you know, three boats down from Alan Watts. And everybody I knew who used psychedelic drugs were very brilliant, very intelligent, very creative people. Okay? I have, over the years, I mean, in those days, I was a teenager in my early 20s, teenager and early 20s. I used lots and lots of psychedelics of all kinds, in Ozzy acid, psilocybin mushrooms, mescaline, peyote buttons, DMT and DET, which I'm sure, Dennis, you know what DET is.
Mm-hmm. Diethyltryptamine.
Yeah. Well, the point I'm trying to make is I have gone on, I've gone to college, I have built a business. I'm a very successful person. I don't have brain tumors, and I'm sorry about your brother.
Thank you.
The reality of the situation is most other people that I know who also during those days had been similarly involved in those sorts of things went on to be very successful in their careers.
Mm-hmm.
The percentage of casualties, I think, is very, very small. I think there's greater casualties from the later drug. See, there's an early drug wave, and then the next one was the cocaine, heroin, speed, methamphetamine wave.
Which came with the materialism wave, by the way.
Well, exactly, Art. That's right. That's precisely it. The first wave was the consciousness wave. Most people were discussing, when they were tripping or smoking pot, were talking about things like, books by Velikovsky, Worlds in Collision, Earth in Upheaval, things like that. The Urantia book, Metaphysics, the early days of health food, health consciousness, Earth consciousness. It's got a bad rap, and I think that the war on drugs has turned into a very politicized power trip that the establishment uses to control people. It's convenient for them. It gives excuses to have larger police forces and larger military and bigger prisons and to spend the public money in ways that we none of us really want to see happen.
Well, have either one of you considered the fact that what do we care about? What reports do we get? We get reports on new housing starts, on national productivity, on all of these things that relate to how productive people are in turning out material things. And I think some of these drugs are considered to be anti-productivity. And I bet that's at the core of a lot of this war. That's just me.
Well, it's interesting. I think you're right, because they saw that too many of the hippie types were going to the nature, wanting to become Native Americans, and were renouncing the civilization, living in teepees. I did that for a while when I was young. Went off into Big Sur, lived in a treehouse, and
exactly. When you could have been in a factory doing something or another, Doctor?
Turning out useful widgets, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
Well, your caller makes a couple of interesting points that I'd like to comment on. One is this notion that, the wider cultural perception is that if you use psychedelics, you have to be somehow drooling in the corner or somehow dysfunctional.
Yes.
And most people, in fact, who have, in which these things have played a role are anything but dysfunctional. They are generally high-functioning, creative people, often on the cutting edge of whatever their field is. I mean, the whole computer and net revolution, the Silicon Valley revolution was largely spearheaded by people who were involved with psychedelics. So there is that element. It doesn't, again, in a very, very small number of cases, some people do run into
something
problems.
Went wrong, sure.
But most
no, he was
do.
Right. In the great majority of cases, these people are now productive citizens. All right, we've got a break here. We'll be right back. Dr. Dennis McKenna is my guest. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Again, Dr. Dennis McKenna, and welcome back, Doctor.
Thank you.
All right. Gee, so many people want to talk to you, so let us continue, I guess. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. McKenna. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. How are you and the doctor today?
Just fine. Where are you?
I am in Indiana, PA.
Okay.
I actually have two quick questions, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
My first is, you spoke of legalization of marijuana and the war on drugs. I wonder if the doctor, in your mind, do you differentiate between those natural drugs such as marijuana and peyote and those which would be considered synthesized, like LSD, in terms of legalization or just simply level of deviance?
Level of deviance.
I don't, you know, it's no nice way to put that, I guess.
Well, no, I mean, if you've been listening to the previous conversation, we were making a distinction between plants and drugs. I'm not a doctrinaire saying that LSD, for example, should be banned and persecuted and peyote shouldn't be. I mean, I think, you know, we have to find a context in which, particularly with the psychedelics, in which these things, you know, can be used in a way that is safer for people, but people shouldn't be denied access to these experiences if they feel that that they should have them. I'm not sure what you do about the war on drugs. That's just one example that, right, you know, it has to do with the fact that you form relationships with drugs or plants, and it's much easier in a way if you have a relationship with a plant that happens to also be a drug. I think it's I think you have a much better chance to have a good relationship with that particular entity if you grow it, if you nurture it, and in return it provides you with a visionary experience. I mean, that is a true symbiosis, and that's what we're talking about. It's harder to have that kind of relationship with something that may come in a gelatin capsule, or in the case of LSD, on a window pane, square of gelatin. Not that it's not possible. I mean, I know that people do use LSD in a creative way, but it's this whole issue about how do we, if people are going to have relationships with drugs, how do we foster, you know, good relationships, mutually beneficial relationships, rather than destructive relationships. And with some drugs, because of the way they work, because of their neurochemistry, it's more difficult to foster good relationships. In the sense, I mean, good, bad, these are charged words, but you know what I mean.
Right.
Relationships that are not self-destructive. With the psychedelics, I think it's much, they lend themselves to a more positive type of relationship because they do open the way into experiences that many people would consider spiritual experiences.
All right. And my second question, pardon me if either of these were mentioned before, I didn't catch the whole program, but not too long ago I was watching TV and I saw something on the CIA admittance of using psychedelics and things like LSD in the 50s for,
right,
I guess you'd call it quasi-mind control, more just...
All right.
Right.
Caller, hold it right there. Hey, that's great, because that's exactly where I was going, Doctor. The government had a relationship with LSD for a while.
Right.
And I guess not such a good one in view of what they did.
Right. Well, these drugs don't particularly have moral qualities in the sense that, you know, if you're a bad person, just taking a psychedelic is not going to make you a good person. I mean, you know, it's a two-sided, it's a two-way street, as in any relationship. It depends on what you bring to it. Just because the CIA used LSD in their experiments it didn't turn them into saints, obviously.
No, it didn't.
These things are morally ambiguous in a certain sense. They can, and you see this again in the traditional context where ayahuasca is used, for example, in Mestizo society in South America. You know, an ayahuascaro, just because he knows how to use ayahuasca, is not necessarily somebody
you can trust or somebody you want to trust. There is a whole other subtext going on of what's called brujería, or what we would call black magic, where, you know, they use the powers to put hexes on people.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in Peru, in mestizo ayahuasquero society, illness, disease, misfortune, all of these things are almost always seen as the effects of some brujo, some evil practitioner having put the whammy on you.
Speaking of evil practitioners, was Terrence or yourself ever approached by anybody in government?
You mean because of our involvement in these things?
Yes.
Well, not since, not for a long time. not since 1969, actually.
69, huh?
Right, right.
But, I mean, were you approached not so much because of your use or as a result of your use, but perhaps to help the government in some way with their proposed use?
No, not really. Not really. I mean, I worked. I did a postdoc in the laboratory at National Institutes of Mental Health. I was there for 2 years, and I was working on a synthetic at the time, but I was basically working on using radioactively labeled analogs of STP to map serotonin receptors, to try to map the serotonin receptors in the mouse brain or in the rat's brain. But I think it's interesting that, you know, I was able to get that fellowship. I went there. I worked there. There were never any problems. And this is actually, this speaks to, one of the issues. People who are interested in psychedelics, in doing research on psychedelics, often say, you know, we can't do it. The government will not allow us to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
That really isn't true anymore. That is changing. Rick Strassman, the fellow I mentioned who just wrote the book called DMT, The Spirit Molecule, he was really the pioneer, and for a lot of this work he showed, I mean, he got tired of people. He was a qualified psychiatrist, an investigator at the University of New Mexico. He got tired of people saying, you can't do this work. So he decided, well, I'll do it. And he applied. He went through all the channels. He got approval, and he was able to give DMT to people in a clinical setting and do this work. That sort of opened, I wouldn't say the floodgates, but it opened the door a crack. And now there are other researchers are, you know, beginning to look into this again. One of the websites I gave you, the Hefter Research Institute, which I'm a board member of, and it's on the web at hefter.org. We're basically a bunch of scientists, neuroscientists, psychiatrists, ethnopharmacologists, people like that, who want to do legitimate research with psychedelics to try to find out, well, basically, not only how they work, but how they might be used to help people.
Well, what about applications in mental illness?
Well, exactly. These sorts of things. I mean, in one sense, you almost have to go the medical model. I don't say that they should always be used, you know, to treat people who are sick. They can also benefit people who are not, you know, who don't really have illnesses, but who might just want to learn from the experience. But mm-hmm. if you're trying to work through these academic, government, and research channels, you sort of have to come up with a rationale. Where, you know, is there an illness? Is there something that these things can treat? And in fact, there are. You know, the focus right now is on things like obsessive compulsive disorder, for example, post-traumatic stress syndrome. These sorts of addiction is another big one. Alcoholism. Potentially, psychedelics could be used in therapies for these sorts of things. But and who knows where it ends? I don't know how many of you saw Andy Weil on 60 Minutes the other night. I didn't see the show, but he actually came out and admitted what he said many years ago, that LSD cured his allergies. You know, so who knows?
Who knows, indeed.
Yeah, I mean, he had an experience where he had been very allergic to cats all of his life, couldn't get near them. One day he was on LSD, and a cat crawled into his lap, and he didn't have any allergic reaction and claimed that he never had one since.
Isn't that interesting?
So that's rather remarkable, I think.
Very remarkable. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. McKenna. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Where are you?
This is Gary from Earthquake Seattle.
Okay.
Everything is going smoother up here, fortunately.
Good.
Glad to hear it.
Yes. Dennis, I was one of those people who had very many good thoughts about your brother. I think he was a tremendously courageous and brilliant person, and I wished he was still with us.
Well, we all do. We all do. Thank you.
Yes, we do. We need more like him. Art, you said a couple profound things I just heard recently. One of the things you said was that, you know, I'm one of the people that feel that our society was on the right track during the 60s, and I think we've taken huge psychic damage since then.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It might have been a bit premature. It could be some of us were not able to put it in context at that time yet, but certainly I think we've gone in the wrong direction since then. You know, one thing, the caller before this, or two before this, he had some great things to say, and I came along at an age group right behind him in the mid-70s, and I was fortunate to go to college and find a group of friends, and after some research, we decided that these substances had been around for thousands of years, even long before Christianity and its teachings, and that's why we embarked upon taking many of these psychoactive drugs, and, you know, we had nothing but positive experiences. I would say to your audience, for instance, they have nothing to fear from these substances. They take you inward and they take you upward, and they lead you to nothing but more profound thinking.
Well, I don't think fear is really the model, but I do think they should be respected. That's the thing. An earlier caller said, for example, that, you know, they're just fun. You should remember, I mean, something that's not being said is they're just a lot of fun. Well, they can be a lot of fun.
That's something Terrence might have said.
They're not always fun.
I completely agree with that. You know, the two experiences, I think, if we had it in our power to give people in the thirst to help us make a psychic breakthrough, I think the two would be to help people take psychoactive substances and maybe to put them in Earth orbit for 24 hours and just let them float there and look down.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would help our society progress more than anything at this point that I can think of for us to do.
Well, in the right context, I think it could. I mean, I think it could. You know, going back to this, what an earlier caller said about how, you know, the perception is that if you take psychedelics, you have to be dysfunctional, or the larger society thinks it drives you crazy, or it makes you feeble-minded or something. You know, in the course of working, I worked with my colleagues on what we call the WASCA project. We did a biomedical study of WASCA, which is the Portuguese transliteration of ayahuasca. And WASCA is used in Brazil by several syncretic churches, one of which is called the UDV, the União do Vegetal. And it's a syncretic church. And ayahuasca is their sacrament. Hmm. What was most amazing to me in the process of doing this study, I mean, we had to hang around with these people a lot. Subjects were, you know, being tested, and we were drawing blood samples, and we spent about 5 weeks in very close contact with this group in the summer of 1993 when we were doing this study. But what was remarkable was just experiencing this society. They're a very close-knit community. In lectures, I refer to them as psychedelic Mormons, with the meaning that is meant to be complementary to Mormons and the UDV, in the sense that Mormons also place a great deal of emphasis on, you know, being productive members of their community, having a close-knit community, being creative, being successful in business, not, in other words, being a drag on the society, but trying to help society. And these people were much that way. I mean, they had much less incidents of domestic violence, for example, than is common in Brazilian society. No alcoholism, no drug abuse. Most of the people were successful. They were doctors, lawyers, businessmen, even politicians. So I was just impressed in hanging out with this group how high-functioning most of them were. And, you know, their kids seemed healthy and intelligent. Their family seemed stable. And a lot of it, of course, had to do with the community that they were involved with. I mean, it was a very, very close-knit community. But I think a lot of it also had to do with the fact that they had this tea, as they call it, this wasca, as their sacrament. And, every 2 weeks at a minimum, they would take it in large groups every 2 weeks. And I think they learned from that. And it helped them to keep their lives on track. There were aspects of the UDV that I would not... I mean, I personally, I don't really... You know, I would not join a cult, but if I was going to join a cult, I...
That might be the one.
That might be the one.
Call her anything else quickly?
I just believe our government, as you said earlier, I think our government fears these substances and does not want people to have access to them. Let's remember, most of them are not physically addictive, as far as we know, in any way, shape, or form, the psychoactives.
The psychedelics.
Psychedelics.
Right.
I believe they lead to far too much contemplation and deep thinking, and the government is afraid of that, just as I believe they're afraid to tell us the truth about what they know about possible extraterrestrials coming here.
Yeah, I think that the caller's got a point here. I think not so much with the so-called drugs of abuse, but with the psychedelics, the fear, the problem is that they make you have funny ideas, and funny ideas are always a threat to the established order.
Well, yeah, they're viewed as anti-productivity.
Well, anti-productivity, or they just don't want people thinking too much. I mean, that's a more sinister aspect of the drug war that does concern me a lot, in that, you know, in some ways, the drug war is not about protecting people from harmful substances. It's about controlling states of mind. It's about saying,
yes,
you know, certain states of mind, certain territories are just off limits, and people should not be allowed these types of experiences. Within the next few years, this is almost certain to happen, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens. But within the next few years, probably through biofeedback or similar types of technology, direct neural stimulation, it'll be possible to have these experiences without using drugs, by using some kind of... electromagnetic mechanism. How is the government going to react?
I don't know. That's fascinating. Well, bypassing laws.
Bypassing laws.
Yeah, that's right. I always ask, Doctor.
Which, of course, will stop the problem.
That's right. Can you stick around one more hour?
Can I stick around another hour?
That's it. I've got only one more hour of the show.
Well, I'm getting a little bit... I'm running a little bit out of steam, but let's go another half hour and see how it goes.
You've got it.
4 a.m. here.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
Fading fast.
Back east. All right, doctor, stay right there. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM from the high desert.